Morning. I'll call to order for the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting for February 23rd, 2016. If the audience will join the board in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Next, public comment number one. This comment period is for the public to address topics on today's agenda. I've not seen anybody move to the mic. Consideration of minutes for 2:16.
Move approval.
Second, any additions or corrections? Sanders.
Aye.
Two. Aye. Those have been approved. Personnel actions as submitted.
Move approval.
Second, anything further? Sanders.
Aye.
Two. Aye. Those have been approved. Consideration of claims for 225.
Move approval.
Second. Anything further? Sanders.
Aye.
Two. Aye. Those are approved. Consent agenda add road closure 1647.
Move approval with the noted change.
Second. Anything further? Sanders.
Aye.
Two. Aye. Those have been approved. No public hearing items. Additional items. Consideration of sending notice of public hearing. Budget estimate to publication, Lisa Markley, Assistant Auditor.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Everybody's favorite.
Right. We are having a staff meeting this afternoon in which we will be handing back the budgets that are included in this budget estimate that we are looking to send to publication. I will not send it till Thursday or Friday, but it will be published on 3-3 with the public hearing on 3-15. At the board meeting. A couple things to note is the tax askings are down in this budget by $1.1 million.
Wait, let me get that straight.
You mean
the governmental
down.
Entity, we're asking for less money than we got from the public last year? How did that happen?
Right, we're just good. What can I say?
That doesn't sound right.
And the levy rate that we're proposing is down 58 cents.
Lower taxes and lower how much money's coming? Golly, what's going on around here, too?
And it is a balanced budget on top of that. The revenues...
How many times in a row?
Four.
And how long was it before we started doing it that it was done in Story County?
20?
Okay.
Is this a quiz?
I'm just feeling spunky.
It's not even an election year.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an election year.
Oh, that's right.
So after reviews by the department heads and elected officials of the budget proposals... I will send it for publication with your blessing, and then we will have a public hearing on the 15th. Okay?
Okay. Any other questions? Take a motion.
I move that Lisa goes ahead and sends notice of public hearing.
I'll second that. Anything further? Sanders.
Aye.
Two.
Aye.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Good job.
Next, discussion and consideration of requested changes to the East Industrial Expansion Area of the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. Jerry Moore.
Charlie, why don't you go ahead and come up, too, because I know I'm going to have questions for you.
Okay, again, this is a request. It's a discussion item, and then ultimately we're asking the board for a motion to start the review process of this requested change. It's the East Industrial Area, northeast of the Mixmaster. It's a part of the Ames Urban Fringe Plan map. This item was before the board September 1 of 2015. We'll show you what the board took action on and what's being requested. And so, again, this is a discussion item, but we are asking for a motion to allow the process to begin, which would start with the Planning and Zoning Commission at the county and then ultimately come back for review to the Board of Supervisors. Just to start showing you the location, this is an aerial. You've got the city of Ames to the left side of the screen, city of Nevada to the right, Chicago and Northwestern Railroad intersects the central part of that space. to the south is the U.S. Highway 30, and then to the west is the Mixmaster. So the area that we're talking about encompasses the location between the two cities, bordered by the railroad and U.S. Highway 30. Just to show you the zoning of that location, much of this area between the two cities is currently zoned A1 agricultural. There are some pockets of commercial light industrial, which is shown in red, and there's a few pockets as well of agricultural to zoning. Getting into the maps, the location again that we're talking about is bordered between the two cities of Ames and Nevada. The northern limit is 210th Street. The southern limit is 245th Street extended eastward to 590th Avenue. This is the current land use map scenario in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. It shows you the planned industrial area, which is the purple or the lavender color. That's east of the freeway, north of the railroad. And then to the south, that crosshatch area is agricultural and long-term industrial reserve. Outside the agricultural and long-term industrial reserve is a green space, which is agricultural and farm service land use. So this is the current map.
Where is 590th on this map? How far?
590th is right there.
Okay.
So this is the map that was before the board September 1, 2015. The planned industrial area, again, was north of the railroad. The idea was that that would shift to the south side of the railroad area. It encompassed a little over 1,180 acres. So that was going to be the planned industrial location. Everything else outside of that was going to be agricultural long-term industrial reserve, and it would be encompassed inside that blue area.
As it already is approved.
Right. So this is the map that's currently being requested. Again, you've got the planned industrial area. There's really three things. One is an expansion of the planned industrial area. The existing planned industrial area, the existing area would stay, and it would be increased to the location, which would be south of the railroad right-of-way, just east of the freeway, and then over to 590th Avenue. Outside of those planned industrial designation, you would have agricultural and long-term industrial reserve, which is the crosshatch area. And then the next change would be to more line up with the planning that's going on with Ames and the city of Nevada. 590th would become the outer limit of that Ames Urban Fringe Area plan. So whereas before, if I can go back to the other one, it's the blue line is the outer limit of that Ames Urban Fringe Area plan. And what would be proposed is it would be shored up. The eastern limit would be to 590th Avenue, going north and south.
Because Charlie, Ames has agreed with Nevada. You're in an agreement with Nevada now not to extend east of 590.
That's correct. We have a five-year-old agreement with the city of Nevada that is essentially the demarcation line of their growth westward, and that's also the limit of our growth westward or eastward. It also delineates subdivision authority in that area also.
Is that a 10-year agreement?
10-year agreement. It's half over.
So, Jerry, we're talking about over from what we originally agreed to, both in the Urban Fringe Plan and what came before us earlier on this property, now we're talking about an expansion of the proposed industrial.
The planned industrial.
Reduction of how far east the Ames Urban Fringe Plan goes. That's new to us. And some additional industrial reserve that was not on in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan or anything we had talked about before.
Correct. It's agricultural, long-term industrial reserve?
North of the rail line, what is different? Is that new industrial reserve that I'm looking at north of the rail line, or was that always there?
That's in the existing plan.
That's existing, okay. And then my final question here is, as I look at this, clearly we've already got some light industrial where the Vetter equipment sits, and it looks to me like that would still be held in industrial reserve. My question would be, why wouldn't we just go ahead and make that industrial as we're doing all of this?
Well, the intent of the industrial is that area that would most likely immediately annex or at least lay the groundwork for annexation. The key thing out here is providing the sanitary sewer and the water,
right?
And we're using the Lincoln Highway corridor to provide that sewer and water. We've also, this purple up here more or less reflects the agreement we just had with Central Iowa Rural Water to buy back the water rights. So our emphasis is going to be on the Lincoln Highway corridor.
And so is it your belief, Charlie, that the city of Ames is going to move fairly rapidly to annex what I'm looking at in purple right there?
I do know that the city has placed the money in the budget for the extension of the utilities out of 590. The annexation, of course, we're going to have to rely on voluntary annexations. And I know the Ames Area Economic Development Commission has reached out to many of the property owners there. They indicate that there is some pretty strong interest in the annexation process. I don't know how fast that will occur.
Okay. And what happened in planning and zoning the other day?
Planning and zoning heard from a lot of the people who still have the small farmsteads and homesteads along that area, even as far north as 210.
Okay.
They considered it too large of a bite at this time, so they recommended not to go forward. We're still planning to take this to the city council for their action. Don't know what the time frame for that will be.
And it is a council decision, right? Recommendations.
Yes.
Okay.
It's also the supervisors and the city of Gilbert City.
Okay. And as you look at this, so I understand what we're talking about with the planned industrial. I've appreciated being part of some of those conversations. It seems to me that the city of Ames' expectation is that this industrial park will grow from the east to the west rather than from the west to east. So you've got Barilla and DuPont kind of as the two anchors that I see out there, right?
Yep.
And it seems to me that everything's been done. So originally, as I understand it, Ames had budgeted to put in infrastructure, but basically just crossing the interstate and just starting to move toward the east. And now Ames has budgeted to go ahead and extend all the way to 590th right now, and that tells me that the expectation is that this industrial park would grow from the east back to the west and fill in. Am I seeing that accurately?
I think we're just laying the groundwork for the whole thing to be developed contemporaneously. I mean, I haven't seen any development proposals. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just thinking also the economies of scale. If you're going to take it, the most expensive part is to getting it under the interstate. And then from there, you know, taking it up to 590th, I think, makes the whole area available, whether it's going to develop east, west, or even in the middle, I don't know. But it just makes the whole area eligible and available for annexation. It also parallels the railroad track, which we believe is a great marketing asset there to have access to rail.
Well, it doesn't. I understand that there are some very real changes in this, but from the concept, the broad concept that was presented to us earlier, I don't, Jerry, see this as a huge change. Tell me if you see it differently than that.
I wouldn't say that there's a huge change. You know, long term, with the proximity of the Mixmaster, the interchange, the location of the rail line there. It's a good location for commercial, industrial development, but it does take, there's a lot of variables into having all this work out, but this is just a plan. Yeah, everything starts with a plan, and then we go from there. You know, you have to have infrastructure planning. You have to have developers and builders who are willing to do the projects, and then you have to have willing landowners. But again, everything starts with this plan.
Okay. One of the main differences between what you saw back in September, at the time we had not yet finalized that agreement with Central Iowa Rural Water.
Right.
So part of that that backfill there between the new planned industrial westward to the interstate, that was now included as part of the agreement with Central Iowa. The Central Iowa Rural Water does not include that far eastern piece on the south side of Lincoln Highway, but we thought for benefit of future expectations that let's include it as planned industrial. It may not be part of the first phase of annexation, but to avoid having to come back at a later time to amend the plan, we included it as shown there.
Okay, so our role today, Jerry, is you're asking us to consider whether we're supportive of continued conversations about changing the urban fringe plan to this, or we're taking action on changing the urban fringe plan to this.
This is just to proceed with the process, and the process starts with the Planning and Zoning Commission reviewing the staff report, the maps, and after they review it, make a recommendation, it would come to the Board of Supervisors.
Yeah, so I'm supportive of continuing the process. I move approval of consider of request of changes to the East Industrial expansion area of the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, and ask that we move through the process.
And I'll second that. And the comment that I'll make that we all need to remember is that there's currently discussions with the DOT, and this area could look a lot different in the next 5 years. And I think this step, at least with the last conversations we've had with the DOT, you know, could be a step in the right direction as far as development in that area, depending on what they finally land on. So
absolutely,
we don't want to get too far in front of ourselves. But so if there's no further discussion, Sanders.
Aye.
Two. Aye. That's been approved.
Thank you. Gary, Charlie, thank you.
Thank you. Agency reports. Juvenile Court Service Agency report. Shirley Faircloth. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning.
Charlie, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How about you two?
Good, thank you.
I always like the opportunity to come and give you guys an update, although we haven't had a lot of significant changes from the last report. There are a couple things that I certainly want to make you aware of. Residents of Story County have a great opportunity on Wednesday, March 2nd, to hear oral arguments before the Supreme Court. This will be held at the Ames High School. The case that is being presented is State of Iowa versus Kenneth Osborne. It's a Polk County case, and the state seeks further review after the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded appellants' drug delivery convictions based on alleged error in jury panel selection process. The state contends that the existing case law that Iowa should follow does not allow a presumption that an entire jury panel has become biased based on the comments of one prospective juror. In this case, it was a pastor who explained his experience with drug dealers and criminal defendants. So it's just certainly nice that we have that locally available, and wanted to make sure that the public was aware of that opportunity. In your report, I've attached a copy of the 2015 stats. From that, you'll notice that our highest referrals are regarding assaults and disorderly conducts. We also have thefts would be probably that third category. We are seeing a reduction in referrals, and I think that's certainly because of the commitment that you have, as a board, have made to our prevention program. So I certainly want to thank you for the commitment that you provide to the residents of Story County. One thing that is different, typically our highest age referral is that 16 and older, and you can note from the report that we are seeing a younger population, and our highest referrals are coming from that age range of 11 to 15.
Do we have an explanation that we think we can attribute that to?
Short answer would be no.
Okay.
I mean, that's certainly something that we're taking a look at and working. I mean, off the top of my head, I don't have the data to prove that. We'd say that some of these are mental health related issues and they're coming into our system in order to get services. Huh. They're not being able to be provided elsewhere because of lack of funding attached to those programs or services and the continued case management of the case.
Do we have a way to track individuals that you're dealing with. Okay, so I get that when we have a youth that needs to enter the criminal justice system, they need to enter the criminal justice system. But if we're having our youth that need to enter the mental health system or the treatment system, and instead we're, due to funding constraints, we're referring them to the criminal side, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, do we have a way to track what portion of those you're seeing?
With our current data system, we do not, unless we track that by hand. You know, and certainly the other impact on that is the change with the MCOs, and we're
right.
waiting for a state, you know, word on when is that going to be rolled out, what does that look like, the numbers that are predicted that we're going to save. Realistically, the only way you can save that money is not to provide service. So, you know, I think that when we have looked at kind of patching holes through Story County DCAT. We've got a mental health program
right.
in that's available to all the schools within the district. But to get the hard and fast data, I don't have a way to track that currently.
Okay. That's something I would be so if as a community, and even go broader than that, society, if and it's even broader than juvenile, but especially in juvenile, if we're moving individuals into the criminal system that we need to be serving elsewhere, I think we're creating long-term problems for ourselves. And I would like for us to figure out how to at least track that so that we can at least say more than anecdotally whether there's a problem or not. I don't like seeing that that you guys are having to get involved with more and more middle school age children than what we've seen in the past, and then to hear anecdotally, which is how I'm taking what you're telling me, that you believe many of those is based on them not being able to get other services or have access to other services that may keep them out of the criminal side.
Correct.
Think about how the first one is identifying the problem, right? So think about how we can start to track that here in Story County to see if there is, and then let's figure out what we can do about it, if anything.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, I hope I'm not asking for too much.
I mean, we've kicked those around, and I think certainly the part of the issue is that our funding becomes in silos. So, you know, in order for us to serve a child, they have to have committed a delinquent act. And so when they present before us, the issues that got them in front of us may have been a fight within the home. It may have been a charge out of Rosedale where that family is in crisis already, and that's the reason they're in Rosedale. So it's trying to determine where those factors are. We're always going to look at community safety, but at what point does that service need to come from juvenile court, and what point could it be another agency?
Absolutely, and that's the line. It feels to me like, at least anecdotally, you're telling me that everything is moving toward juvenile court, because that's our failsafe, right? That's the end of the line. When we don't service an issue somewhere else, they end up with you.
Correct.
I want us to. So I'm a huge fan of government spending as little as possible. I'm a huge fan of efficiency and everything else. But the reality is, we all, at every level, have a huge role in this, but we've got to be able to identify the problem to get there. And this is one of those areas, Shirley, that if, hopefully you've never felt, sitting in front of this board, that we're penny-wise and pound-foolish. I mean, this board, I think, has proven time and again that we'll spend the dollars where we need to spend the dollars if somebody will help us address what the issue is and where the shortfall is. And I just think, since it's fallen to you guys like it is, even if it's tally marks, I mean, we need something to try to tell us that, yeah, more than anecdotally, there's an issue here that we need to be addressing on the other side. And if that's through expansion with YSS or expansion with some other contracts, or even if it's just to wait and see how the new MCO system, if we get there, is actually going to address some of these things, I'd just like to be a little more on top of it than it feels like we are right now.
Certainly. We will keep you posted and try to bring a clearer way to bring some of that specific data that's the underlying issue.
Thank you.
Well, we are training all of our staff, and they'll be trained by April of this year in effective practices and community service. And you'll hear that, it's actually community supervision, and you'll hear that referred to as EPICS a lot of time, and it really is an evidence-based service. And traditionally, when I started in the position over 30 years ago, when we met with clients, it was really conversations regarding compliance with probation agreement. And we really are moving towards much more focused, identifying meetings, identifying those criminogenic needs and barriers to success. So we're teaching skills, we're role-playing with clients to practice those skills to reduce the barriers, and that is really the focus and conducted in the majority of our sessions with each client. And the outcomes certainly show that it does reduce recidivism, which is something that we're all looking for.
Absolutely.
Regarding the budget, I think really there's not a lot of significant change. The protective living, which is that share of shelters outside of Rosedale and detention, I think we'll have a balance remaining there. The total balance was, or the budgeted was $110,000, and we have a balance of $82,000. So even between now and the end of the fiscal year, I don't think that we'll be spending that down. With our sheltered workshop, that's the support that goes to Rosedale. That money will all be drawn down. We do have a report from Youth and Shelter Services, and that shows that we've had 15 placements in Story County. One thing the report does not show, and as noted, is those child welfare emergency services placements, and those are placements that can be made by law enforcement, Department of Human Services, or juvenile court, and they do not need to be court ordered into the facility and are for 24 hours or less. I am working with Rosedale in order to get those specific numbers for those CWIS referrals, because the county is reimbursed $41.80 from the state for those placements. So I would like to be able to provide you with that specific number. However, I don't have it available today. The other remaining budget items that are really programs through YSS, that being the employment assistance, the agency services, and the public education, and the Nevada Outreach Center, I believe will all draw down those that funding that's been allocated. I have attached a report from ASSET that includes their recommendations for funding for FY 16 and 17. One thing I did want to point out from the YSS Rosedale report, the theme of the narrative really indicates that they are receiving more and more requests looking for long-term placement options. So that goes back to our discussion that we just had on why is the need for that. I mean, some of that is that clients have failed in a PMIC facility, a psychiatric facility, and then we're trying to maintain them in a lower structured and certainly not as intensive treatment at Rosedale, and then we see issues rising out of there, which at sometimes do include new delinquent charges. So that's something that as we move forward, Rick, we can certainly have that as part of our discussion. Programs that we offer to Story County have not changed specifically. They're listed in the report with a description. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. In addition, the Story County DCAT services are also listed there. If you have any questions for me, I would certainly be happy to answer them or provide additional information.
Shirley, just how much we appreciate you and the work you do.
Thank you.
I'm sorry that it appears your job's getting tougher rather than not tougher. We'd like to put you out of business if all possible.
Well, I would agree with that. Yeah. And actually, I think some of our challenges are becoming tougher, but the caseloads are reducing. But we need that extra time to deal with the more challenging cases.
More complex.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Next, Mary Greeley Medical Center Home Health Service Annual Report, Kyle Breeze, Director. Kyle, I was on time for this meeting this morning, so. I was a little tardy for my Board of Health last week.
So. Thanks for having me. My name is Kyle Breeze, and I am the new director there, replacing Eileen Mullen just about 8 months ago. First off, just allow me to thank you all for your support of our services and what we're doing. It's not without your support that we can do what we do. I did bring at least that I'll leave here, which is an article from the Minneapolis Star Tribune of 1 week ago. And what it talks about is how, one, that people that are the baby boomers that are aging, they've watched their parents age, and they don't want to age like they did. They don't want to go to assisted living. They don't want to go into institutions. They actually want to stay in their own homes. They actually want to stay in the suburbs there and grow old and live successfully there. Two, suburbs didn't plan for this, and they have no idea how they're going to help take care of these people in their homes. And so these, in this article, refers to how these communities are kind of rallying together to figure out what are we going to do with this diverse population living in our communities long term. And so I think it brings to forefront what we do, which is help people live successfully at home, getting the same level of services that they can get in a facility, but coordinating it, providing it where they are. And we're continuing that charge and doing it successfully. Again, I don't think I need to go into who we are. I think you're well established with who we are. Integrated with Mary Greeley, what does that allow us to do? It helps us give people the right care in the right place at the right time. You know, I don't need to tell you about all what's going on in the industry, but with our arm, what we're able to do is reach out and keep people from going in and overflowing an ER, keep people from going into excessive doctor visits, get them, hook them up, coordinate the care with the right service providers, the right agencies that can help them where they are. Again, why do we do all this? Our goal is to help people live successfully at home. We're really in the business of quality of life and helping people define that for themselves. And we also exist to serve those that are most vulnerable. We can touch on that real quick as we go over our challenges. How are we doing this right now? The way we do it, one, is to use data. If you don't know, my background is data and dollars. I'm a CPA, finishing a master's in statistics. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to lay out what are we doing and how we're addressing those issues. At a seminar in the last fall, United Healthcare, their corporate group, they talked about how 2% of their population accounts for 40% of their spend. And they said half of that 2%, we don't know about till it happens. So we want to use our data to get out there and find these people, to get them hooked up before they're not all of a sudden in the system and in a disaster type of state.
Yeah, I mean, that should translate to ultimately some savings.
Absolutely.
If we get them in a month, right?
Absolutely. So it might mean some investment in those preventative services, that ability to identify, but
sure,
the back end, absolutely, the net total spending would decrease.
Well, I'm a huge fan of spending a little bit now to not have to spend a lot later on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so in the second way we're doing that is collaborating through pretty much all carrot, no stick, building our relationships, rebuilding our infrastructure here to know how do we identify those problems, how do we get the right services to the right people when they need it. If you want to hear about our stats, again, our clinics on the public health side, we're on pace for our highest utilization since H1N1, which is a pretty big deal. Nursing, we're going to have the most nursing visits we've had in 7 years. AIDS, that's where we have an opportunity to grow to sell these services that, again, are gatekeeper-type services. Work with our physicians to say, hey, are you seeing people that could use a visit from someone to help them around the home, help get them a meal? These services that we can provide that, again, can help people be successful, what we need to do is make sure we're getting those out in front so people know they're available, know to call us, know to get us involved so that we can, again, get them on our radar, help have an eye, and support them in the community. Hospice, we have 20% growth in utilization this year. Again, we're trying new things as well. We have looking to engage the community through art therapy, through new programs that we've brought about. On the home care side, we're partnering right now with Mary Greeley on the ED case management. So we've taken a look at some people that you might call frequent flyers to the emergency department. And one way that we are just right now trialing is we send a social worker that we have hired out to one of these people that are excessively using the ER. And we have demonstrated success in helping reduce those ER visits by doing just some initial simple assessments. So we're looking at how we can roll that program out, not just at Mary Greeley, but as well as Story County Medical Center and Boone County Hospital as part of a community effort to help hospitals where they need help most. Again,
see if we anything else we want to touch on. We are finishing up right now our 2015 Community Health Needs Assessment for Story County. That report will publish sometime this week. We do that in partnership with the Story County Quality of Life Alliance. I won't go into detail unless you want detail on what that group does, but that'll be available shortly. And that what that's going to do is that's going to be the first step in using data to help direct the work that we're doing as a community. Challenges we're facing, again, you know about the Medicaid and Medicare challenges, you know, increased reimbursement pressure, changes in providers. What do we face? You know, we're working in an environment that is more than 75% for-profit, and so we are really left with the patients that are vulnerable because, and let's face it, we know that they're not making a profit when they serve those patients. So that's what makes us unique in that industry, is that we are not for-profit. We do exist to serve those populations. We don't have the same resources as those for-profits, and so we have to come up, we have to think on our feet, have to use different resources, and again, I think we're in right now, that's what we're trying to leverage our data, leverage our relationships to really build progress toward that. With that, I'll just turn it over to any questions or concerns. I apologize for not bringing a formal report. I'm not sure if
it's nice to have you here. What can we do? Where can we be of more assistance to you?
I think right now we're just looking at reestablishing those relationships that do exist in the community. Coming out of our community health needs assessment, one of those priorities is going to be physical activity, well-being, outside of Ames and Story County. And so in the first week of March, we'll be meeting here to start establishing a coalition that's going to say, how do we help people be successful? It's a large task. It's a five-year cycle we're looking at, but we're going to, you know, we need to bring people in, engagement. I mean, we need engagement. We need people to, everybody cares about it, but how do we take that next step to say, how are we going to come to the table and partner?
Well, I just want to say as the chair of the Board of Health that I'm very happy with the relationship that Story County and Mary Greeley Medical Center has had. I think it's been over 30 years that Mary Greeley and formerly Elmore have contracted together to provide the public health portion of county government. And I know in different meetings with different supervisors that they were in a similar situation instead of having the public health and have to, one more thing they have to deal with. So we're very pleased with what we've received over the past 30-plus years and look forward to more.
Thank you.
Likewise.
Likewise.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kyle.
Okay. Other reports. Discussion of alternative compliance issues for the irons. That will be Jerry Moore. If you need just 1 minute, I got to make a real quick call.
Okay.
Good. Thanks.
This is a discussion item only. It's a proposed residential subdivision that happens to be located also within the Ames Urban Fringe Plan.
Actually, in the rural urban transitional area of that plan. Again, discussion only. I'm sitting next to Bob Gibson with CDA.
Also, here today is Chris Gardner with Bella Homes and Corey Strait, the general manager of the Ames Golf and Country Club. Again, this is a residential subdivision. They're proposing single-family and two-family homes or bi-attached homes. And what they would like input today on is the alternative compliance provisions, and Bob will address those at the end here. But it's with alternative compliance, what they do is they have to provide proof and details that their plan proposes, that the plan that they're proposing is equally or better than the standards that are in our development regulations. So just to show you where it's at, we're in the northwest part of Ames. The city of Ames corporate limits is shown in blue. Ames Golf and Country Club is the property. It's 154-acre parcel. To the north is 190th Street. To the west is George W. Carver. The east-west road there is Cameron School Road. And you see the Golf and Country Club in the western central portion of the site. This is the county zoning map. Currently, the west and the north portion is zoned R2, which permits single-family residences and two-family or bi-attached. The balance of the ground is zoned A1 agriculture. This is the concept drawing that was submitted before conceptual review, which was before the departments here at the county January 28, 2016. At that time, they showed 14 single-family lots off of a long cul-de-sac in that southwest portion of the site. And then north of that, they were showing two separate roads or drives adjacent to four total bi-attached, and then eight total bi-attached. And then along 190th Street, three separate single-family lots. Getting into some of the comments from Environmental Health, again, the idea was that in an R2 district, there's a requirement that you have a common water system and then a common septic system. So the comments there were that lots 1 through 14, which would be the single-family homes, initially they were thinking about a rezoning request from R2 to R1 for the single-family, and that they would be using these Advantex systems, which Bob can talk about later. And then also that the discharge would be from that system would go to the pond to the east, and then that the bi-attached units would discharge to the pond to the north. The engineering department indicated that permits would be needed for accesses, that there's a 300-foot spacing requirement, that the two lots along 190th that are close together, that they would need a shared drive. And he's commenting that the stormwater and the wastewater should flow with the natural topography to the southeast. Auditor's office indicated that if a subdivision were to occur, that it should include the entire property. Planning and development, again, it's R2 zoning, so it does require a common sewer system to be provided and a common water system. Currently, Xenia Rural Water is in this location. There is, however, no public sanitary sewer. All lots are to have frontage to a public or a private road. There's also a 15% common or open space requirement for the residential development, and it's open space that's supposed to provide exclusive benefit for those homeowners within the development. And then it also talks about a homeowners association to be created to address the maintenance of that open space. With this plan, there's potential for removing the existing maintenance building with where the bi-attached homes are proposed. They would need to build a new maintenance facility for the golf course. Conceptually, they're thinking about the northeast part of the course. Under the current zoning with R2 and A1, the golf course is not a permitted use. So likely to build a maintenance building may take them through a conditional use permit process to get that accomplished. And then we had a comment about the length of the lot. There's the depth to lot width. The depth cannot exceed three times the width. On the drawings that Bob will show you, they've adjusted that. The furthest south lot, which was labeled lot 14, was too long. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bob.
Okay. Well, we've got basically three issues that we need to address the alternative compliance with. And the first two are specifically to the R2 zoning. And we are coming in, I'm going to actually give Jerry the documents today for the rezoning. And taking some of that R2 that I showed you earlier that wraps around the north and the west side, we're going to change some of that back to R1. To allow for the single families, which takes away that common sanitary issue. But with the R2, we're still facing that. And it does technically, your ordinance does say common systems are required. Well, in this case, we're only dealing with a maximum of about, I think, 17 townhome units. And what we're proposing is using those Advantech systems, which are really a self-contained and a treating system, and the effluent is pumped through and out, and it comes out really clean. It still has some levels of phosphorus and nitrates in it, but it's really clean and suitable for irrigation. And so the plan is to each unit will have its own system, but every two units or so will have the systems combined, and where the effluent would be pumped out singly into a pipe, and that will go to those ponds. And that's kind of what that drawing is showing there. And it's schematic only. It's the travel paths have changed a little bit with a little more design. But is that understandable from that drawing where I'm showing you what we've got going on there?
So you would add, so two units would feed in, yeah. Two living units would feed into one system.
Sort of.
Okay.
Each unit will have its own system here. And so that's where it all gets treated, and then it moves on to the next tank, and I forget what it's called, Chris, the next.
Well, there's a primary and one primary.
Yeah.
So each unit would have its own primary,
right.
Where its wastewater would go,
right. Yeah.
And then from there you're talking about it coming out and being combined to go to the second.
Yeah, and getting pumped out and on out. And not everyone, just because of the number of units and everything, not everyone is going to have a combined system like this unit right here. It's just going to be on its own. But these two here will share, and these two, I guess it's just this one on this side. Now, ultimately, the city is looking at annexing this in at some time, and when they do, then there's going to have to be sanitary sewer provided, and we're providing easements for that. And likely here, what we're proposing is a sanitary tank right here. And at that time, then what we're showing is the sewer stubs coming out of the unit to the side. So it works a little bit better with the single families, but they'll abandon this system and then just tie in here and bring it out to the sanitary. That one's been escaped. They just go right back to the sanitary. So that's what we're proposing here. Jerry, if you want to show the lower.
Would it help if that light's off? Okay, can you see it? Okay.
And basically the same thing is going on there with those. These lower three that are behind on the south side of the drive, they're going to actually drain into this pond to the east, along with all the single families. And the single families, these, they're going to be separate units. I guess that we're not dealing with alternative compliance there, but just because it's they're going to be separately owned lots, whereas the townhomes, it's going to be more of an association approach and maintenance. So it works a little better than that.
Helps me. I, Margaret, you're here. I'd be really interested in your perspective.
Got the other slide.
While we're here.
You want to sit here? Okay.
We've discussed this before, and we've talked about mainly going with the Advantech systems, which is fine. It does a good job.
You like the Advantech systems?
I do, yes. The state requires the counties to require sand filters before we consider using mechanical systems. But in this case, I believe that we could get an agreement for the neighborhood to do maintenance. So that would definitely need to be something you would need to do. Yes. So whether or not you put two
two houses on one system or everyone has their own, it really doesn't matter as far as treatment.
Okay.
Because they're all going to tie and either go to laterals or the pond. So if you've got one, two, or six houses on an Advantex, really doesn't matter. It's a wash. It's all going to be treated the same. It's just,
and it ends up in the same spot regardless.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Now, a couple things. At first, we talked about going to two different ponds, you know, either low pressure or gravity. And I looked through the city fringe plan, and they talk about BMPs. And I think...
And tell me what BMPs are.
Best management practices.
Okay.
Okay. And the conferences that I go to and that, BMPs then are going to laterals instead of discharging to the surface or to a pond.
Okay.
Okay, so I would like to see that. And then what has changed from when we met a few weeks ago versus what is shown now is it looks like the systems are, especially like in the single-family dwelling area on the cul-de-sac, they are in the backyards instead of the front yards now. And I don't, and so 10, 20, 30 years from now, when we go to hook up to city sewer, I think, it, I guess I envision them being stubbed to the front and a sewer line being put in place while the road is being constructed so that the city can hook on easily. That's the idea behind common systems, is that so that we could morph into an annexed city-served neighborhood versus on-sites.
Can I address that?
Yeah, sure.
Well, first of all, Mark, that road's getting constructed right away. So,
okay.
You talk about the cul-de-sac?
Yes.
That's getting constructed with this. And we had talked about putting them up front in the front yards, but we looked at the possibility, and again, this is schematic, but Chris and I had discussed, what if we just stub them out the side and then we can put these units in the backyard? They're not real big. They're really not much bigger than that desk right there. But still, they've got, you've got a big, you know, PVC cover on them. It's green, but I don't know, nicer in the backyard. But when the city annexes, the sewer's going to come up right along here. And we will have these stubs on the sides of the units, and so they can go back on the side yards and dig up the side yard to attach and then connect to the sewer there. Mm-hmm. And we thought that would be a little less intrusive, you know, on your side yard rather than smack up the middle if you've got a system there or you've got your stub there. So we're anticipating making it as simple as possible for the homeowner, so you don't, it's getting bad enough when this whole side has to get torn up to put in the sanitary itself. But the stubs will just go up the side yards, be able to serve two together, basically, rather than individual one on each. I mean, they're going to be separate services, of course, but...
Why wouldn't you, if you're going to put a stub in anticipation of city sewer at some point, why wouldn't you run a line right out to where the street is? So that way, when you come to hook up, instead of tearing up somebody's yard, all you got to do is dig a hole in, you know, at the street side, and you've already got your hookups already there. But I mean, that's cosmetic. I mean, it's up to the, you're just tearing up a lot less existing yard at that point.
Have a dead end line would be the problem.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. You would be tearing up less area, right? But that's why we also think the side yard works well, because it kind of accomplishes both. The line coming out of the basement, it's flowing the right direction, it's flowing everything gravity out of there. It can split to the rear lot line for right now. In the future, it can split to the front. So it kind of works best in both worlds. It allows us to get effluent out easier, more efficiently, in the right direction too, with gravity and the low pressure lines for the effluent.
Barbara, explain lateral versus, I understand the effluent going to the pond, uh-huh. But explain laterals to me.
They would either be pumped or gravity fed to laterals, just like a conventional line, okay? And what that does is it distributes it into the soil, and then the soil absorbs it for tertiary treatment. Uh-huh. And, you know, if you wanted to recharge your ponds, it's almost the same as piping it right to the pond, because it will infiltrate through the soil, and then if you design it to run to the pond, then it would, okay? So you're just getting extra treatment from the soil by putting it in laterals as opposed to discharging directly to the pond, where you may have people getting in that water and a potential pathogen exposure.
Sure. And I get that, and clearly we wouldn't want anybody in these ponds or pulling fish out of these ponds or anything like that, and I understand that. But it seems to me, if what I'm hearing is accurate, so they're talking about taking it straight to the ponds rather than through the soil to the pond.
Correct.
Straight to the pond, but then they're talking about using that for irrigation, which means to me they're taking it out of the pond then you're immediately and putting it on the ground, which then has the same effect that you're talking about. So I could see your concern if this were going to the ponds and then just sitting there. Mm-hmm. But if they're truly using this as irrigation, and I've been out there enough to know they do a lot of irrigation out there, then in essence you're getting it into the soil fairly rapidly, I believe. And I don't know if that impacts the way you feel about it or not, or if it should.
That's an excellent point. I just think that, you know, in the winter you don't irrigate. In the spring you don't irrigate. You know, it's all in the summer. And whereas you're getting, you know, effluent around the calendar. So just as a safety precaution, we could do some research and see if there's a difference. I know we've run into this situation on that practice golf thing on South 69, south of Ames. And it's been a huge issue trying to get a NPDES permit and getting some cooperation on that level. I'm looking to avoid that.
Good. I'd like to address if I could. During a lot of our meetings, we've been real concerned about phosphorus in this area. It is within the Ada Hayden watershed.
Right.
We have two sources of water, of drainage in the Ada Hayden. We've got surface drainage, and we have subsurface drainage, groundwater. Mm-hmm. And our public works and water pollution control people actually supported the surface discharge. The amount of phosphorus that comes out of these various units doesn't reduce or adds a little bit more phosphorus into the system. The goal ultimately is to get a 60% reduction in phosphorus because of the changes in golf course management that will occur after some grading and different approaches to irrigation. We wanted to keep any phosphorus loading on the surface into the pond where it could be used again and be taken up during the irrigation.
So the city of Ames would prefer to go into the pond first,
right,
rather than into laterals where it's in the soil.
Correct. Okay. We did like the ability to surface discharge the effluent, keeping it out of the watershed, out of the groundwater. So even though you could direct the laterals in such a way that it could get to the ponds, it's like a direct inject vent. You know, we just want to keep it on the surface to the greatest extent possible.
So you want it not as deep. Margaret wants it deeper. I mean, you want it in the pond or on the surface. Margaret likes the idea of it being not in the pond or deeper in the surface where it can flow through the soil. I mean, I'm just trying to make sure I understand that I'm hearing two different things here.
Looks like we're going to probably have to walk this thing through at the preliminary class stage, make sure we're all on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of, you know, competing interests.
Sure.
So a couple things about that. The laterals are like at 18 inches, 20 inches deep, so they'll still be quite shallow. It's not like it's going right in the groundwater. You have to have 3 feet separation to the groundwater where the laterals sit. Okay, so that's one thing. And the other thing is phosphorus is mostly transported on sediment, soil sediment. So erosion control is the most important thing for phosphorus control. Now, if you want high phosphorus water in your pond in order to use that as greens irrigation, that would be one thing. Are you concerned about your ponds, you know, eutrophication of the ponds with the added phosphorus in them? These are questions for the manager of the golf course.
Yeah, we've talked about it briefly, but they would take maintenance. We know that they would that.
Yeah, it would take some extra maintenance, but not anything excessive on that.
As far as phosphorus making it to Ada Hayden from this, yeah, putting it in laterals is the better way to go, in my opinion, soils wise and pathology wise.
Yep. All right.
And then one other comment. Okay, so the stubbing out of the side of the house, whether you go in the front yard, backyard with your Advantix, I get it. Putting in the backyard is a little less ugly, and that's just fine. But what I'm wondering is when that road goes in on that cul-de-sac, when the cul-de-sac road goes in, will there be a sewer line that the houses can eventually connect to, or will the City of Ames taxpayers have to pay for that after the fact?
It will be after the fact, but there will be an easement, but that line is not going to go in there.
We already have assessment agreements with the owner, with the golf course, and that's transferable to subsequent property owners. That if they're responsible for putting in the sanitary sewer, the mains, as well as the service lines in the future at their cost. And we do have an agreement that they will pay for any assessments necessary to accomplish.
So it's not going to ride on the taxpayers, but the people who buy these places from Chris better know that ultimately when the City of Ames comes that far, they're going to be assessed to put in this entire, not only tying their house on, but putting in the main line as well.
If we knew it was going to happen in a year, it would be obviously a no-brainer to do it now. The problem is we don't know, and we can all make assumptions. But it could be 20 years from now, then to have dry sewer lines sit in the ground for 20 years, they could be ineffective at that point. They could be bragged.
Okay, that's a good point.
So that's the problem, is we just don't know what's going to happen.
Okay. Margaret, anything else?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next. So that took us a little beyond the alternative compliance issue, but it was a great discussion to have.
Sure.
So the technicality of the alternative compliance is we're going to request that we use this Advantix system rather than have a common community-wide or, you know, tied into some public sanitary system.
And I would like to just add to it, in my opinion, we can obviously there's different interpretations of how things are defined, but it is ultimately all connected, and the effluents are connected to a common line. So,
yeah, there is a commonality,
right,
technically to it.
Right.
So,
yeah. So it's not
it's all going to the same place.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really it does kind of come down to a technicality of the language. So that's the first one. The second one, still regarding the townhomes, is. County requires that all lots have frontage onto a public street. Well, can't make that work here with these townhomes.
Here, don't we say public or private?
Public or private.
Yeah. So I think we're good there. The way I'm reading it, I think we're good.
That's the actual world.
I'm actually really appreciative that the first drawing had additional entrances off of George Washington Carver, as I saw.
Right.
I'm really appreciative that
this one
appears
works.
To be, yeah, we're getting down to where you would have an entrance at Cameron School Road for the,
yep,
single family and the main entrance of the country club. I also want to get rid of that maintenance access drive that's just north of the main country club drive. Hopefully that's in there. And then my concern becomes 190th Street, where I'm seeing three different access points off 190th. Two plus the one that Corey's going to need to get back to that new maintenance shed over by the railroad tracks, which I'm, for total purposes, I'm just looking at how 190th is going to be impacted, and I see three between George Washington Carver and the railroad tracks. I don't know if that's 300 feet apiece, which is what we require, I believe, but I'm seeing those three, and we need to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I know they're 300 foot rule works on that.
Good.
But that's public. Is there a separate for private? Mm-hmm. Okay, where you might run into an issue with the private streets, looking at that, yeah, there's those private drives in the cul-de-sac. It's a required right-of-way width. You know, we've got that. It's tight area there, and we've got basically a 24-foot drive, and the lots are configured right up to that drive. So if that 24 foot of the paving can also be the right-of-way and considered a private street, then we are good. And if not, then we'd ask that it just be considered a private drive and these lots...
waived the...
Yeah.
And what's your derivation of that, Jerry?
Well, normally the lot is adjacent to a road right-of-way.
Right.
And with that, that's where you usually have your utilities, your green space, drainage area. And so we probably need to digest this because this is a little different than the conceptual review drawings that were submitted.
Okay.
And then probably visit two with Darren.
But let me just be sure I'm clear. We're going to have no responsibility for maintaining these, right?
No, not even a single-family cul-de-sac.
Right. So we're going to have no responsibility for maintaining them. We need to make sure that they're adequate to not cause problems, but let's see what our rules allow along those. But I'm not reading that we've got a problem with the whole must be adjacent to a public road. I think we're okay there if we can make sure that they're substantial enough.
Mm-hmm. Now, like I said, we have a 24-foot road, and we've kept the garage, the face of the garage, a minimum of 24 feet from that, so there's room for parking and walking and whatever. We could widen that right away, Jerry, if we just say there's reduced setbacks, so we can call it a private street. Maybe there's some way we can work it out that way. But if we can't, we'd still like to come in and ask for that alternative compliance on that issue.
Okay.
But if there's a way we can make it work, that's great. So. All right, and the last one is your requirement for 15% open space. We actually, Chris and I asked for this a couple years ago on Bella Woods, and what we talked about back then was that 15% was more geared to the R1 zoning that has a minimum lot size of 10,000 square feet, and if you've got a whole subdivision of that, and I'm sure that the reason for that requirement is that just to provide more open space when you have these smaller lots. When we have lots that are averaging about 28,000 square feet, how necessary is that? And plus...
if the intent is to make sure that we keep some open space, I don't think that's a huge issue with what you're proposing here.
And they're actually technically a way that we can satisfy that to the letter, because there's some room
back in here where originally this property was defined to come out back here.
Right.
We could say that's the 15%, but it doesn't change a thing.
Yeah, are you talking about putting a pond or a wetland down there right now?
Possibly a little
different. Depending on how much dirt you need? I mean, is that what it comes down to?
Well, yeah, this we're not looking at taking out for dirt. That's the other pond there. So we could satisfy it that way, but it just seems odd that, okay, these guys are responsible now for the maintenance of this little triangle, and it'll give them nothing.
Is there something?
So I'm curious, Gary. Let's say that they were going to dig out and put a pond in right there. The ground that a pond sits on, is that part of the open space requirement that we have?
If
there was a pond put in down there on the southeast corner of the single family homes, and that was put into the ground that goes with the single family homes, would that, by the letter of the law, meet the requirement of open space?
I think it works toward that end. I mean, the idea is that anybody who buys a lot in that development has that space that they can go to walk a dog, to walk, to throw a frisbee, to go
whatever. So the word I heard is,
in that space.
Clearly you got the entire golf course. I mean, so what, 138?
If you have a membership, you have the golf course. Oh, it does?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
But I heard exclusively for the use of homeowners.
Right.
I think this is one of those areas that we ought to be as flexible as we can possibly be in terms of the open space area. But it seems to me like there may also be a way to get there without causing any real hardship to anybody if, in fact, a pond or a wetland or something like that is being put down there in that corner. Then it's not a huge maintenance issue. It's not a place that you're running any of these affluent lines if, in fact, that's what you do with them. And it could be relatively easy on everybody while maintaining what the regulations are.
Okay.
another thing along those lines, I think I might have added my narrative to it. This is being done under the City of Ames Conservation Subdivision, and part of that is there's got to be some area that's going to get kind of reestablished prairie type conservation area. And we are allotting a 25-foot easement at the back of these lots, and then there's going to be a 10-foot shared use path running along Carver all the way north. So, and even that's additional area. You know, you're going to have the naturalized 25-foot strip, but then you're going to have a 10-foot pass. So that's walking area, too, that provides open space, a place to walk a dog.
Just, I should have asked it before Charlie left, but is the city concerned at all about the lot size on the single dwelling?
I think they are okay with the lot sizes.
They addressed it in each other's arms.
Yeah.
One thing that Leon pointed out to me is in our development regulations, you can have a private street for single-family lots up to four lots.
So there's more than that, okay.
And so there's more than that, so potentially that's something that the alternative compliance.
Okay. And so tell me how these alternative compliance. This is discussion only today.
Correct.
Tell me how, if we go forward with these alternative compliance, in your all. How does it, tell me that process.
It would be through the platting process, but because this is in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, the process actually starts with the City of Ames, with okay. their Planning and Zoning Commission, with the preliminary plat, then it goes on to the City Council. After the City Council, then it comes to our Planning and Zoning Commission, and that's when the alternative compliance would be addressed. Yeah. They would review it, take action, and then it would come before the Board of Supervisors.
So help me with this. Wasn't the Urban Fringe Plan intended to try to keep developers from having to jump through multiple hoops and different? So I'm hearing we've got some different interpretations of what needs to be happening up here. And it seems to me that when we put in the Ames Urban Fringe, and Leanne, maybe I'm looking to you as much as anybody since that was your role back when we did this, wasn't it intended to stop this kind of stuff where we're, okay, it goes to the City of Ames, and once they approve it, we're going to come back and we're going to ask for different things than the City of Ames wants?
Well, it's just because it's in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, it doesn't exclude them from, you know.
But there was supposed to be a leader. I mean, as part of the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, as I recall us doing, and Lee, come on up and help me if I'm missing this, it was supposed to designate who the leading group, whether it be the county or the city on any particular issue, was going to be, and the other side of that was going to kind of defer to what the lead group did. Is that right?
It is. And that's where we have, if you'll recall, the three categories of the land use classes, the urban, it's been a while.
Right, sure.
I'm not going to get the titles right, but the urban area, the rural
transition,
and then this rural urban transition area.
Right.
That's what this is in, and that's where it is the most complicated because the agreement spells out that we have to closely coordinate. In that urban area, the county is hands off. In that rural area, the city is essentially hands off. It's this rural-urban transition area that we can never come to any type of a easily modifiable process that could just be one person and one set of regulations because we do have two competing set of regulations. So unfortunately, it's this area that does get really muddied and messy.
Well, so it just seems to me that the City of Ames has more onerous requirements than the county. Typically, the City of Ames has more onerous requirements than the county does. I think this is a unique property, this 100 and whatever, 50, 160 acres is a unique property. It's not like we've got to worry about opening a can of worms by doing something out there. It just seems to me that if all else fails, we ought to lean on what the City of Ames thinks is appropriate in this area rather than us. And that's what I would suggest is do. But if we were going to do that, Jerry, what does that do to our process? And who takes action on this?
Well, and that's, you know, partly why we are before you today, to get some input on this, get input on this proposal, and talk about the process. But again, because it's in this transitional area, this is an area that's not, we don't know when it's going to be annexed. If it were going to be within a year, then it might be a little easier to say, let's just defer totally to the city of Ames for most of this and
well, we'll give you the flip side. Let's say it's never annexed. Okay, let's say that this piece of property, for whatever reason, never gets annexed, right? The Borgmeyer Farm, Chris is not sharp enough to go get the Borgmeyer Farm and build houses on that thing. Let's say it never happens. What's the downside to the county in this one specific instance of saying we're going to defer to city requirements for this one piece? We understand it doesn't meet with our rural development guidelines, but this is not a rural development. This is a golf course development. That's different. Right. What would be the downside of the county doing that if this never annexes?
I don't know that there would be a downside. And I mean, to me, probably the biggest issue is probably the issue with the septic systems, you know, because it's in an R2. Our standard says it's got to be a common or a central system. I think they're interested in going through a rezoning process to change it from R2 to R1 so that they can do on-site systems for each of the single family. But then ask for alternative compliance for the bi-attached.
Sure, for our rationale for having one system, which I get. The rationale for having one system in a subdivision like this is we want to make sure that all of that treated sewage is ending up in one spot. I would argue this is doing exactly that. Right? So if our intent is to have
efficiencies
all in one spot,
and looking out for environmental issues as well.
That,
it's combined.
Well, I will tell you, I mean, if we care about the environment, we love the environment here. The city of Ames, how they protect Ada Hayden, and the fact that this is in the Ada Hayden watershed, we're not in their ballpark, I think.
To me, it makes sense if the city of Ames is satisfied with what was being brought forward. I don't know why we wouldn't be. And I know the only discussions that we've had in the past with the engineers, I think the city requiring is a 50-foot easement for right-of-way for roads, and the county has a 60, and all that's for is that we want the 10 extra feet to pile more snow when we're piling snow. So if it comes down to that, you know, if the city of Ames can get satisfied from the developer through this, then, you know, and it is. It's, you know, I think that Ames Urban Fringe Plan was one of the first things that you and I approved.
Just want to know where the developers have to go.
Right. And
right.
We haven't got that answer yet. So, Margaret.
One more comment. If they consider this a common system, 16 people or more, or 4 units or more, it's a DNR thing, and county drops out. Okay?
Okay.
And most folks don't want DNR in it because it's a lot more cumbersome routine to go through. Just my 2 cents.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that we're walking a fine line between what is an individual system and ultimately, and so I don't think I'm asking whether this is a common system as much as I'm asking, is it meeting the goals of why the county has the language of having a common system in? That's what I'm asking more than anything else. Okay, so you're not asking us for action here. You're asking us for direction. I think what you're hearing from the two of us is there would be comfort from the Board of Supervisors if we work really, really hard to make sure that we're meeting what the City of Ames requires, that not deferring to them by any way, shape, or form, but we are acknowledging that they should be taking the lead in this, and we want to make sure ultimately that whatever is determined does not nullify the intent of any of our county regulations. Now, I'm not talking about the letter of our county regulations. I'm talking about the intent of our county regulations. That's what I'm hearing, Paul, unless you're suggesting something different than that.
No.
Does that give you enough direction to move forward?
I think so.
Yeah. It's interesting. This conversation has been had a lot over the last 30-some years. I mean, I lived within a couple miles of that golf course for 10 years, and every so often you hear, well, you know, the country club wants to build houses, but the county's not going to let them do it. So
I never get interested in running for the Board of Supervisors without my RUD. Then I was president of the country club. My role in kind of revived this conversation, Corey, if I recall right, started before 84, but it was had in earnest in 84. And then in the early to mid-2000s, Larry Curtis, rest his soul, push this thing really, really hard. I think this was something he was really, really passionate about. And it was my first experience dealing with the county. Had to have been 2005 or so, dealing with the county, and it was one of the things that frustrated me is the number of hoops you had to jump through, where it was one meeting with the city of Ames and another meeting with the county, and hearing different things from both sides. So it has been a long process.
Well, 84 is when I moved up there, and I think that's the year that they paved George Washington Carver. Or Cameron School Road was paved in 84, so... When I looked at that house the first time, the road was gravel.
That house doesn't exist anymore.
That house is not there anymore.
That tells you how old you're getting.
Yes, right.
Anything else for us, Gary?
I think that's it. Bob, do you have anything else?
No, that's it.
Margaret, anything else? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for everybody. Okay. That's going to take us to public forum. Number two, comments from the public on items not on this agenda. The board may not take any action on the comments due to the requirements of the open meeting law, but may do so in the future. See anybody move for the MAC liaison?
Pass.
Announcements.
We got a meeting tonight at 5:30.
Correct, for the city assessor.
Just reminding you.
I'll be there.
All right.
And Wayne is representing us today at the National Association of Counties Legislative Conference in D.C. And I'm sure he's doing a bang-up job. So.
And he wanted to Skype in.
He wanted to Skype in. I talked him out of it.
I move adjournment.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thanks, everybody.